Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and this episode will be a continuation of the coverage of the Corey Richens trial. We left off with days 6, 7, and 8. Now we're going to start off with day 9, which took place on March 5th. Day 9 continued the prosecution's push to solidify the timeline around Eric's death and strengthen the state's theory that Corey deliberately poisoned him. The theme of that day was tying together behavior, relationships, and her access to fentanyl. The courtroom first heard from witnesses connected to the couple's personal life and the events leading up to Eric's death. So Chelsea Barney, who is one of Corey's close friends, she took the stand. Chelsea had previously been mentioned during testimony about the property deal where she had wired money to Corey in the tune of like $45,000 to help purchase a home for Chelsea. So prosecutors revisited that situation in detail. Chelsea testified that she trusted Corey as both a friend and a business partner. She wired about $45,000 to Corey with the understanding that the money would go towards purchasing a property that would ultimately be transferred to Chelsea. But as jurors already heard through the forensic accounting testimony, that money never went towards the home purchase. Instead, it was quickly absorbed into Corey's accounts and used for other expenses. Needless to say, Chelsea testified that when she later questioned Corey about what happened to the money, Corey reassured her everything was under control and that the situation would be resolved. The prosecution appears to be using this testimony to show a pattern, this financial desperation and misleading explanations to people who are close to her. And it turned out that Chelsea did end up moving into that home and then was evicted because the home went into foreclosure and she had no idea that the paperwork for the deed, that all this stuff was never actually filed. So Corey just led her on for weeks, if not months, and then all of a sudden Chelsea had to leave this home that she thought she owned. So, I mean, ultimately, like, betrayal is part of Corey's playbook. It comes naturally to her. A law enforcement officer testified about the investigation into Robert Crozier, the man prosecutors say ultimately supplied the pills to Carmen Lauber that she gave to Corey that allegedly contained fentanyl. So the officer walked jurors through how investigators tracked the alleged transaction between Crozier and Carmen Lauber. And phone records, surveillance, and location data were discussed as investigators reconstructed how Crozier and Lauber allegedly met to exchange those pills. Prosecutors emphasized that the transaction took place at a Maverick gas station in Draper, a location that has repeatedly come up in testimony, and the defense cross-examined pretty aggressively, suggesting investigators could not definitively prove what was exchanged during the meeting. But the state's broader strategy appears to be pretty clear, just to reinforce the chain of events that allegedly moved the pills from Crozier to Lauber to Corey. The day ended with additional discussion about text messages and communications between the key players, further building the timeline that prosecutors have been constructing since the start of the trial. Moving on to day 10, which took place March 6th, day 10 centered heavily on investigative evidence and witness credibility, particularly surrounding the drug transactions that prosecutors say led to Eric's death. So again, investigators walked jurors through interviews conducted during the investigation, including conversations with people who had contact with Carmen Lauber and Robert Crozier. The testimony detailed how law enforcement began piecing together the alleged drug purchases after Eric's toxicology report revealed fentanyl being in his system. Detectives testified that investigators initially had no clear explanation for how Eric could have obtained fentanyl on his own, and that discovery led them to examine the people around Corey. Investigators explained how phone records and interviews pointed them towards Carmen Lauber, the house cleaner who worked for the Richens family. When Lauber was interviewed, she eventually admitted that she had obtained pills for Corey, believing that they were oxycodone. So those pills were later determined to contain fentanyl, according to the prosecutors. But the state also introduced additional evidence showing the frequency of communication between Corey and Carmen, reinforcing their claim that Corey was actively seeking pills and then actively seeking stronger pills. As we know, when that Valentine's Day sandwich, you know, attempt didn't work out, or at least that is what the state is alleging. Defense attorneys focused their cross-examination on inconsistencies in witness statements and investigative assumptions. They repeatedly emphasized that Carmen initially lied to investigators and only changed her story after being confronted with evidence. And I think that the defense probably also suggests that she lied or changed her story because she was getting that immunity deal and had something to gain from helping the state, right? So the defense also suggested that investigators were quick to assume foul play once fentanyl appeared in the toxicology results, because by the end of the day, they didn't investigate any other sources of how he could have gotten that fentanyl. They just kind of seemed like they had tunnel vision, or at least that is what the defense is trying to suggest to the jury. The next day was day 11, March 7th. Day 11 brought testimony from first responders and investigators involved in the immediate aftermath of Eric's death. The day focused heavily on the night Eric died, including what was happening inside the home and how the emergency response unfolded. A paramedic who responded to the scene testified about arriving at the Richens home early in the morning after Corey called 911. He described finding Eric unresponsive in bed and said that attempts to revive him were unsuccessful. Jurors also heard details about what Corey told first responders that night. According to testimony, Corey said she had brought Eric a drink before bed and later found him unresponsive. Investigators testified that at the time, there was no obvious sign of foul play, and Eric's death initially appeared to be unexplained. There was even talk about him possibly dying from an aneurysm or something natural, essentially. However, that changed once the toxicology results came back showing fentanyl. The prosecution also revisited the Valentine's Day incident, where Eric allegedly became violently ill after eating a sandwich that Corey prepared for him or bought for him from this diner and then gave to him. But prosecutors are suggesting that event may have been an earlier attempt to poison him. And that is one of her other charges, is attempted murder in addition to the aggravated murder charge. And the defense has argued that there is absolutely no proof of that. So I guess that's just kind of where that ends, is like, that's just speculative. There's no proof. There's simply no proof. Throughout the day, jurors were reminded how investigators gradually shifted from viewing Eric's death as a medical mystery to a potential homicide investigation. Now, I'm going to pause here because as I go through these days, and just as I've been watching this trial, I really do try to get into the mind of the jury and think like what they could possibly be thinking if they have absolutely no knowledge of this story, like you and I might, right? Like I covered this in episode, I believe 137. That was like 100 episodes ago when this first came out and there was the book and there was the revelation of her affair and all of this stuff. You know, we are privy to all of the emotional context of this story before it ever went to trial. However, you have to assume that through the voir dire process, these jurors have been chosen because they have no knowledge, no bias, no nothing connected to this story. So when they're sitting there and they're presented with all this information, having no context clues, it makes you wonder how effective the state is and how effective the defense is. And I just have concerns because I don't think that they have been able to definitively prove within a shadow of reasonable doubt that she committed these crimes. Aside from Carmen's testimony, there's no other proof of how she got these illicit street drugs, right? Like we know that she was communicating with Carmen to get these drugs, but we can't definitively prove that she did it with the intent to kill him because the defense is trying to portray Eric as someone who recreationally used drugs in the past with these red devils that some people are saying is code for PCP and some people are saying is code for Sudafed, which are two very, very different things. But at the end of the day, we just have no proof of which exactly is the truth. And so I have a feeling, I just fear that the jury is going to struggle with things like that, especially as it pertains to the aggravated murder and the attempted murder charges. Again, you know, she said that she gave him a drink the night before, but the cups were never collected. There's no proof that there was ever fentanyl in those cups, aside from the fact that he ingested fentanyl. And trust me, when I say, like, I explained this case to Austin, he and I were talking about it this morning, and I was saying, you know, anyone with common sense can probably tie these clues all together to surmise that she probably did it. But in the court of law, when you have to convict without a shadow of a doubt, because you so firmly believe that the state proved their case, that's where I get nervous. It's not because I think that she's innocent. I don't think she's innocent, but I don't think that the state has proven it without a shadow of a doubt. So that's where my concern is. Okay, moving into day 12, March 10th. Day 12 returned to digital evidence and communications, further exploring Corey's activity before and after Eric's death. Prosecutors introduced additional text messages and phone records that investigators recovered from various devices. A digital forensic analyst explained how investigators extracted data from the phones, and then jurors heard testimony about searches and communications that occurred around the time Eric died, including discussions about the toxicology findings. The prosecution's focus remained on behavior that shows consciousness of guilt, including phone activity and attempts to manage information after Eric's death. But the defense attorneys pushed back, arguing that many of the actions being described could have perfectly innocent explanations. They also emphasized that digital evidence cannot always determine who specifically used a phone at any given moment. Jurors also heard recorded jail calls between Corey and her mother, where she kind of mocked the investigation. In one call discussing the prosecution's theory that she poisoned Eric using food in his truck from that Valentine's Day lunch, Corey said, "What in the hell? They are nuts." At another point, she complained that investigators had created some wild theories, saying they come up with some wild shit. And her mom referenced the alleged poison sandwich theory, telling her, yes, on the seat of his truck is what it said. And Corey responded that these accusations were ridiculous. And then jurors were shown a journal entry that Corey wrote on March 3rd of 2022. This was essentially like her recollection of the evening, but it was written in a journal. And it was almost like something you would expect to be written in a police report, because she wrote exactly what happened that night, that she woke up in the middle of the night and noticed something was wrong. She nudged him and she didn't respond, that he felt cold and heavy. And that's the only way she could describe it, was heavy. She said, Eric looked pale and yellow and that his mouth was open. And according to the entry, she said she tried CPR and described the chaos when EMTs arrived, writing that blood was squirting everywhere. Some people that I've seen online suggest that maybe she was writing this all down so that she could reread it over and over and remember the details of her story so that she wouldn't get them mixed up in the future. But some people, you know, keep journals and they write detailed entries regularly. So who's to say? But jurors also watched video of police interviews with Carmen Lauber, and they basically told her she could get a quote unquote get out of jail free card. They actually used those words. When detectives told her they needed information proving Corey's involvement, Carmen reacted emotionally, saying, "Oh my God." And then she told investigators that she wanted to cooperate and to help. So, you know, that's one of the things that Bloodworth described in closing arguments, because I'm recording this on March 16th. So closing arguments have started. And one of the things that Bloodworth and Judge Mrazek pointed out is that if there's a witness who testified that might have something to gain, whether it's because of a governmental relationship or otherwise, you have to consider that when you decide on their trustworthiness as a witness, essentially. And I think that they're kind of hinting towards this. And I'm sure that the defense, when it's their turn to present their closing arguments, they will probably jump on that as well. And then, of course, you have the walk the dog letter. Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, and that is Time for Learning. Now let's talk about it. Something I know a lot of you have either thought about or you're already doing: homeschooling. And if you are in that season of life where you're craving flexibility, or maybe your child just doesn't thrive in a traditional classroom setting, I want to tell you about Time for Learning. Now, Time for Learning is an all-in-one online curriculum for pre-K through 12th grade. It covers all the core subjects plus electives, basically everything that you could expect from a traditional school, but built for home. And what I love about it is the flexibility. You can mix subjects each day, you can focus on one subject at a time, take learning on the road, or adjust your schedule around your real life, doctor's appointment, travel, just one of those days. You're not locked in to rigid school hours. They even have something called the Cinema Series for middle and high schoolers, which are story-driven, visually engaging courses that feel way more modern and immersive than what most of us grew up with. And for parents, this is huge. They provide transcript templates, grade tracking, and planning tools that align with homeschool requirements in all 50 states. So you're not just winging it and then hoping that you did it right. Because I know that a lot of people who struggle with the idea of homeschooling worry about the fact that they're not competent enough to teach their kids these like intricate lessons, but you don't have to think about all of that. They've been around for over 20 years and have served more than a million students. So this is not just some fly-by-night program. Families actually trust it. If you're curious if Time for Learning is right for your family, visit time4learning.com. That, again, is time4learning.com to explore their curriculum and find the perfect plan for your student. And you can get started with a monthly subscription to see just how much your kids enjoy learning on their own terms. That's timeforlearning.com. So this is a 6-page letter that Corey wrote in jail to her mother that investigators found among her belongings. And the letter referenced a friend named Ronnie and suggested that Eric had hidden drug use. So defense attorneys questioned whether investigators ever verified those claims with Ronnie, and they didn't. O'Driscoll is the detective who testified that they tried to contact him, but investigators were unable to speak with him, allegedly. So the defense, let me back up. The walk the dog letter is essentially this letter that Corey wrote to her mom. She wrote it while she was in jail awaiting trial for the death of her husband, and investigators found the letter during a search of her jail cell, and then prosecutors have used it as part of their evidence in the case. Prosecutors say it wasn't simply a personal message, but rather it appeared to outline a plan for how someone should present information to investigators or the media. Because of the way that the instructions were phrased, investigators believe it may have been coded guidance meant to shape the narrative about Eric's death. So the name Walk the Dog Letter comes from one of the phrases that Corey used in the letter. She wrote in big, bold letters at the very top of the page, walk the dog, in like huge font. Prosecutors say that phrase appears to function like a code or shorthand for delivering or passing along the information she outlined in the letter. So the letter allegedly suggests that Eric may have been secretly using drugs. The letter also mentioned a friend named Ronnie who supposedly knew about that drug use, and encouraging this idea that this information should be shared in a way that would influence the investigation. So the state's argument is that the letter wasn't just speculation, that it appeared to be a deliberate attempt to steer the story in a specific direction. The defense, however, pushed back on that interpretation because they argue that the letter was written by someone under extreme stress while in jail. The letter was not actually sent or even acted upon, and it does not prove that Corey committed the crime, rather that she was trying to relay information that she desperately wanted investigators to know about. So, you know, they've also questioned whether investigators thoroughly followed up on the claims mentioned in the letter, and they didn't. So the letter was really all for nothing, but the state is trying to use it as proof that Corey was trying to manipulate the evidence or manipulate the narrative altogether. And the last piece of evidence they talked about that day was the children's book that Corey wrote called Are You With Me? Prosecutors presented text messages and emails showing Corey promoting this book, and investigators testified that text messages showed she discussed the book with a ghostwriting company and planned to promote it publicly. So the reason they brought up the ghostwriter is because she was telling people she wrote it all herself, but if you use a ghostwriter, You're not writing a book all by yourself. You're essentially giving your ideas to someone who is well-versed at writing, and they will help you craft it. And it's basically like using ChatGPT. You can like give it a prompt, like, I want to write something about this. And then ChatGPT is essentially the ghostwriter. So in one of the text messages, she hoped to sell 100,000 books by the end of the year. And I think the state was using this to further push the narrative that she was just money hungry and that none of this was actually from genuine grief or compassion for Eric's death. Now, moving on to day 13, which was March 11th, this day featured additional testimony tied to the financial and insurance aspects of the case. So prosecutors continued exploring what they say was Corey's potential financial motive. They had insurance company representatives testify about the life insurance policies that were connected to Eric. They explained the claims process and confirmed that Corey did receive significant life insurance payouts following Eric's death. Jurors also heard more about policy details, including the timing of certain policies and beneficiary information. But surprisingly, day 13 was essentially the end of the prosecution's case. The state wrapped up its final witness, the defense tried to poke holes in the investigation one last time, and then both sides made major decisions about how the rest of the trial will proceed. I was shocked by this because I, from the get, thought that this trial was expected to last 5 to 6 weeks. So the state presented their case first, they took 3 weeks, essentially, and then they rested, and then the defense got up and said that they rested too. They didn't even call a single witness. So I was really shocked by that. But before that happened, Detective Jeff O'Driscoll was on the stand testifying. He is the lead investigator for the Summit County Sheriff's Office. And a lot of Nestor's strategy on day 13 was to show that investigators did not find physical evidence tying fentanyl to Corey inside of the house. So for example, she asked directly whether detectives ever located fentanyl during the investigation. And she said, actually, quote, in all of that, we have no murder weapon. You haven't found anything connected to Eric's death. No fentanyl, correct? And O'Driscoll responded with one of the more memorable lines of the morning, saying, quote, there was a boatload of fentanyl in his stomach that came out of the house with him. End quote. So I'm sure that landed like a bomb for the jury, I would assume anyway. But the defense also asked about a bag of loose hydrocodone pills that investigators found in the mudroom of the Richens' home. O'Driscoll testified those pills were tested for fentanyl and came back negative. So this point was clearly meant to suggest that Eric may have had access to prescription medication in the home and that the source of fentanyl might not necessarily have been Corey. But prosecutors have consistently argued that those pills were not connected to Eric's death. Another strange moment came from when phone evidence resurfaced. So the defense walked through the memes and the GIFs, 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 however you want to pronounce it, investigators recovered from Corey's phone that had been accessed the morning Eric died. So three images were accessed at 8:29 a.m. on March 4th. One of them was a meme of Donald Trump saying, I'm really rich. Another meme that read, quote, idiots, idiots everywhere, end quote. And then there was a GIF of a woman wiping her tears with cash. So the investigator testified that while these images were accessed on her phone, investigators could not definitively prove who actually viewed them. That detail, though, gave the defense something to work with. Nestor also pushed the investigator on the exact cause of Eric's death and the uncertainty around ingestion. She asked questions about whether investigators could determine exactly how the fentanyl entered Eric's body, what dosage he consumed, or whether it could be tied to a specific delivery method. O'Driscoll acknowledged investigators could not answer those questions with certainty. The defense also brought up the Valentine's Day illness, suggesting Eric may have had a severe allergic reaction that day and even referenced EpiPens that were found in the refrigerator. Investigators confirmed Eric did have seasonal allergies and EpiPens were found in the home. However, I believe those were for one of their sons, and they did not tie that event to fentanyl. Then one of the biggest legal fights of the day happened before the jury even entered the courtroom. The defense wanted to question O'Driscoll about a man named David Norris, who claimed Eric had once asked him about obtaining fentanyl back in 2019. But Judge Mrazek ruled the testimony could not come in because it was hearsay. When Nestor tried to get around the ruling by asking questions implying Eric sought drugs, the judge shut it down. He warned the defense that if they opened the door to this theory, the prosecution would be allowed to introduce damaging statements about Carmen Lauber's boyfriend saying she had just made money selling fentanyl. So at one point, the judge described the strategic decision facing the defense as high stakes poker, and ultimately the defense backed off and did not pursue that line of questioning. Another piece of phone evidence came up when Nestor asked about some text messages and images that were accessed on Corey's phone the morning Eric died. The investigator confirmed that photos Eric had sent Corey the day before were viewed again the morning of March 4th. The defense suggested this might indicate normal phone usage rather than anything suspicious. Then, late in the morning, the defense made a standard motion for dismissal, arguing the prosecution had failed to prove its case. Defense attorney Alex Ramos argued that the state had not produced sufficient evidence to prove that Corey actually administered fentanyl, or that she intended to kill Eric, or that the insurance policy documents were fraudulent. The judge denied the motion as a surprise to no one. Judge Mrazek said the prosecution had presented believable evidence that a jury could consider when determining guilt. Then, just before lunch, prosecutors officially rested their case. And after lunch, the defense announced something that surprised everyone, I think, that they would not be calling any witnesses at all. Corey Richens also waived her right to testify, which we kind of had a feeling was coming. And that means that the defense case essentially lasted only a few minutes and then they rested. So I think they took the next day off. I believe that was on Thursday and then they took Friday off. I think that's what happened. Anyway, today is Monday the 16th and we are going through closing arguments now, and then the case is going to go to the jury much sooner than I anticipated and probably many people anticipated. So with that out of the way, I'm going to go ahead and focus on those closing arguments, and then I will be back with a major update. The next episode that I release for you guys will be the closing arguments and the verdict once it's out. So I'll see you then. Until then, stay vigilant, stay curious, always ask questions, question everything. And until then, I'll see you next time. Mama Mystery out.